My name is Bob Wilson, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found a need or an excuse to take a drink since May 28th of 1973. I'm a Norwegian from Wisconsin. You probably don't know much about us. Kind of an unusual breed. Before I go any further, I need to tell you that you are extremely fortunate to have a person managing this conference that's as beautiful and talented as Shirelli. This is a great conference. I've had a great time here. I've gotten to see an awful lot of old friends. Some of the people that I've sponsored in the past have moved into the Los Angeles area, and some of them have homes out here, and it's just a great time to see all of them. What I really want to talk about tonight is I want to talk about recovery, and I want to make the point that you can get as well as you want to. You can, by practicing the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous, make your life better, become more successful. You can do all sorts of things with spiritual principles. I belong to the Happy Way group in Englewood, Colorado, and I didn't pick the name. Sounds like a bunch of people on Thorazine. See, I'd like it to be called the Beaten Into the State of Reasonableness group, or maybe the Outright Mental Defectives, or something like that. But some really sweet little old lady named that group, and God bless her, we just put up with it. So. The Happy Way group in Englewood, Colorado, is kind of the step workers. We're the Nazis. If you don't want to hear about using the 12 steps to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, you probably ought to leave right now. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1973 for the last time, it wasn't the first time. I had been going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings starting in 1968. I just didn't get it. I used to go to meetings drunk. I thought that turning myself in periodically just made things better. So I'd go sit in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting drunk and let people stroke me. Tell me I was going to be all right, and it was an outrageous lie. I don't tell people that. I don't tell people it's going to be all right, and you're going to be just fine, and keep coming back, and don't drink and you won't get drunk, and bring the body and the mind will follow, or any of that kind of bullshit at all. I tell people you're probably going to die. It gets their interest right away. Actually, the book says that. It suggests that we tell people that they are afflicted with a progressive and fatal disease, and to stress that. And so it was kind of curious. I thought it was really mean to tell someone that. But I know I haven't found any lies in the big book, and I've been reading it for a long time. So I thought, well, let's see how that works. So somebody came in, and I was talking to him, and I said, well, you got a progressive and fatal disease. And they said, what's going to happen? And I said, you're probably going to die. And he said, well, Isn't there any hope here? And I said, probably not. And I'll tell you why that works. He looked at me and he said, then how come you're not dead? And then you got him. Say, well, I did this. And see, the big book is a really interesting book, and I just love the tense that it comes from. The tense that the big book comes from is, we will show you what we have done. Doesn't come from this tense about, I'm going to show you what you ought to do. It comes from, I'll show you what I did, and you can make your own decisions. And see, we're not beating anybody, even though we're a Real Step working group at Happy Way, we're not beating anybody into sobriety. We're just saying, if you don't want to do that anymore, if you do what we did, my guess is it may work for you. And then people seem, if they're desperate enough, seem to gravitate towards it. I got sober in a city in Wisconsin, Fond du Lac, which means bottom of the lake, which pretty well describes my life at that point. I had a wife that hated me and kids that were afraid of me. My wife actually took her two sons and left me, went to France, decided that living on the French Riviera was a hell of a lot more fun than living with me, and she left, and I woke up on the floor of this empty house with after being on this binge, and I don't know how long it lasted, and I was in a blackout for a long time, and then I woke up, and I was looking up at two members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the longer-term sobriety guy was a person who had volunteered to be my sponsor on the occasions, the rare occasions that I went to AA meetings. And he brought a new guy with him, which is what we used to do when we went to people's houses. And he brought this new guy with him who was dancing around like he had drank too much coffee, and he was going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. What are we going to do with him? Oh my God, is he gonna go into DTs? What are we going to do with him if he has a convulsion? Oh my God. He was appropriately named Dick. So they got me up and took me to a halfway house. And they set me down in front of this priest, which was not a big thrill for me because I know Clancy was a Norwegian Lutheran, I was a German Lutheran because part of my family was German, but they were basically the same kind of thing, where they would sit there and pound on the pulpits and try and scare the hell out of you and give you 57 ways you were going to go to hell in the next 5 minutes. And so they put me down in front of a priest, and see, if you were one of those Lutheran sects in Wisconsin, you didn't have a high opinion of priests. And so I was suspicious right away. And this guy said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes, I am. And I think that's the first time I ever told anybody that. And he said, are you done? And I said, if I'm not, I'm probably going to die. And now at that point, my liver was sticking out of my side. My liver had already grown to about the size of a football, and the doc said, are you drinking a lot? And I said, no. I'd been drinking a fifth a day for about 15 years. And he said, well, this doc said to me, I don't know what you're up to here, but if you keep doing it, your chances of a heart attack or a stroke are 80% in the next 4 years. My cholesterol was somewhere in the stratosphere. And so I was sitting in front of this priest, and he said, do you want what we have? And I didn't know what the hell he had, but I knew what I had. And I didn't want that anymore. And he said, are you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, yep. And he said, do you believe in God? And I said, no, just to piss him off. And then he looked me right in the eye and said, then you're shit out of luck. Well, that's not a very appropriate thing for a priest to say. And I asked him why, and he said, can you stop drinking? And I said, no. And he said, well, I got some bad news for you. We can't stop you either. There are enough people in this town to stop you from taking another drink if you want one. And I said, then what am I doing here? And he said, well, there better be a God, or your game's up. So I said, I don't know what to do here. And he said, why don't you go home and figure out what you'd like God to be? And I said, that sounds a little silly to me. I mean, I don't get to decide. And he said, well, just think what you'd like God to be. I have a degree in it. And when you come back, we'll talk about it. So then they drove me home. Now, they didn't have any treatment centers, so they just took you home and left you there. Now, I knew what was going to happen because it happened to me before. And that is, I knew I was going to go into DTs, and I didn't know if I was going to go into convulsions, and I didn't know if I was going to survive the experience. So they just took me home and left me there. That's quite an experience. I would recommend that to anyone trying to get over alcoholism. I laid down on the couch and waited for the inevitable, and along it came. And all of a sudden, I started seeing hallucinations and flopping around like a fish out of water. And I went into the kitchen. I don't know why I went into the kitchen, and all of a sudden there were ants bigger than this podium coming out from under the refrigerator. And I ran into the cellar steps and got three cans of Raid and emptied them in this little tiny kitchen and goddamn near asphyxiated myself. They left me there for about 2 days. And I saw things I'd never seen before, and I flopped around and waited to die and felt like my chest was going to seize up all the time. I can still feel it today. It just feels like all of a sudden somebody parked a truck on your chest. And after a couple of days, they came back and looked in the door to see if I was still there. And I was, obviously. And they took me back to this halfway house and sat me down in front of this priest. And the priest said, did you think about God? And I said, yeah, as much as I could. I kept trying to pray when I was getting sober. And I didn't know how to make God listen. So I was trying Old English and New English and on my knees and, you know, with my hands folded and all these different things that I'd heard from religious people before, and just hoped that God was listening. And after 48 hours, it came and got me, took me back, and he said, so what would you like God to be? And I said, I'd like him to be like a father. Because my father was a violent drunk. It was interesting. I was talking to a really good friend, a lady, that today, and was talking about how my father would hit you before you knew he was angry, which is really disturbing. I mean, because you're walking around like this all the time, waiting to get punched, when you know there doesn't seem to be any reason. And so I said I'd like him to be like a father, but a father that really cares about who you are and really wants you to be successful in life and doesn't come along with a bat and hit you every time you step out of line, but gently guides you into the right action. And I wish that I could find a God that looks like that. And he said, well, this priest said, I think that's exactly what God is. So off I went. I went to meetings. I remember one of the first meetings I went to was a men's meeting. And they were all sitting around in there talking about how much fun they were having sexually with their partners, and I was impotent. And I thought something unusual had really happened. And they were all sitting around talking about having a great time and everything, and after they had that meeting, I went over and talked to the priest. And I said, I'm really bothered. And he said, why? And I said, I'm impotent. And he said, that's not unusual. And I said, well, it must be, because I was just in a men's meeting, and without exception, they were all talking about how good life was at home with their partners. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, what's going on here? And he said, half of them are lying. Well, that was the first time I ever figured that you could lie in an AA meeting. I moved to Denver when I was just about a year sober, and I knew I was going to drink again. You know, all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was this thing that was on a piece of paper that said how it works. I didn't even know that was in a big book. And I went to Denver and they said, well, you read how it works. And I said, where's the paper? And they handed me the big book and I went, okay. And they said, no, it's chapter 5, Bob. And I knew I was going to drink again, and I knew I couldn't survive it. I mean, I was so far down the road the last time when I got sober in 73 that I could not go that far over the edge again and live. I knew that. So I heard a guy at a Sunday night young people's meeting in Denver, show you how long ago that was. And he was talking about the big book being a textbook, and that there was a precise set of instructions in there. And he read the forward to the first edition where it says, to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And I was just fascinated with it. He said, you not only don't ever have to drink again, you don't ever have to want to drink again. And, you know, if somebody would have read me the 10-step promises in the beginning, I would have fought them. This whole idea about being neutral to alcohol, I don't get it. I spent my whole life being wrapped around a bottle. And all of a sudden people are telling me, no, you don't even have to think about it. And see, when people said things like that to me, I wanted to fight. So I went up to him afterwards. His name was Don Pritz. He's dead now. He was my sponsor for 32 years. And I said, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. You're talking about all this stuff like it was some sort of program. You sounds like you got a set of instructions and that they work, and where'd all that come from? And he says, right in the book. And I said, well, would you show me? And he said, you need a sponsor. And I said, yeah. And he said, are you willing to come over to my house and sit across the table from me once a week and work on this? And I said, yeah. And he said, let me ask you a couple of questions. And the first thing he said, well, so what have you done so far? And I said, well, I go to meetings and I really try and be a good person. So if somebody's moving or something, I'll help them. And I'll make coffee and do stuff like that. And he looked at me and he said, well, it looks like you did everything but follow the directions. And I said, I don't know what the directions are. And so what we did was we sat down and we started at the forward to the first edition, and he said, we're going to do something unusual, and that is we're going to do everything this book says to do. So I said, all right. About that time, the 1975 International came to Denver. Now, the Internationals are a lot bigger now, but we had 17,000 drunks in Denver, which was quite a bunch. And I was on the hospitality committee. And there was a guy that spoke there that came down from Winnipeg named Mac Cheater. And he talked about a group in Winnipeg called the Golden Slippers. And the Golden Slippers were called that because nobody gets sober. And and they were having a terrible time. They didn't know what to do. I mean, they were AA, but they weren't getting sober. So they decided to take a brand new approach towards Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is that they weren't going to discuss the steps, and they weren't going to intellectualize about the steps, and they weren't going to do any of this other stuff about the steps. They were going to take a whole new approach, and that is they were going to do the steps. So that's what they did. They sat down and they started at the forward to the first edition, and every time it said write, they wrote, and every time it said make a decision, they made a decision, and every time it said to make amends or do anything else, they all did it. And so there were 14 of us at that meeting, and afterwards we said, let's go do that. And we got in this guy Jay Levy's basement, and we did exactly what we had heard. I can tell you that out of the 14 of us, 13 of us either are sober or died sober. And the 14th was a guy named Eddie Durkin that decided that he just thought it was way too much trouble. And he died in a doorway on Larimer Street, which is the Skid Row in Denver. This priest in Fond du Lac kept asking me, do you believe in God? Do you believe in God? What do you think about God? And I kept telling him stuff like, I try not to think about God. And he kept pushing me and pushing me to consider the idea of God. And he said, and then my sponsor came up to me and he said, why are you sober? And I said, it's because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, bullshit. You've been hanging around in AA meetings for 5 years and you never got sober before. What's the difference? And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, are you eating differently? And I said, no. And he said, are you exercising? And I said, no. Well, are you going to work every day? No. Well, what's different? Well, quit asking me. I don't know what's different. And he said, "Are you praying?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Why are you doing that?" I said, "Because you told me to." And he said, "Were you praying before?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Would you concede that you're sober today by the grace of God you don't even believe in?" Well, that's quite a concept. I don't know, I had to think about it. Do you want to know something funny about drunks? We'll die right in front of you to keep fighting you. We will. I'm amazed at drunks. They want to fight, they want to argue, they just don't want to do what the book prescribes. And they will take it to their death. I don't get it. You know, it finally occurred to me that all the really tough drunks are dead. They just kept going till they keeled over. You know, it's all us weak sons of bitches that had to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Are you even willing to believe, the book says, upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built? I became willing to believe grudgingly. I didn't just find it all of a sudden. I had a spiritual experience that lasted over time, and I finally had to say the only thing that's different in my life is that I have turned to God. And today when people come up and say, "Well, I just am not up for this God shit," and say, "Well, then I can't help you. I just am not up for playing games anymore." You know what? 36 years, I am real straightforward with drunks. And it isn't like they're running away. I mean, I'm taking half a dozen people through the steps right now. But having somebody wanting to argue with you all the time, say, you want help or not? Are you desperate enough? You want to do this? Do you want to stop drinking? Are you tired of feeling the way you are? Are you over it? You want to go out and try it some more? Don't waste my time. You know what people in Denver say? You better get your shit straightened out or you're going to wind up with Bob Olson as a sponsor. When we got to the third step, we all got, the 14 of us got on our knees and said the third step prayer together, and it was a real spiritual experience for me. My sponsor had me read the third step prayer before, a week before that meeting, and he said, "What I want you to do is I want you to consider that for a week, and this whole business about," he said, "what do you think, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt means?" And I said, "It sounds like he gets to do anything he wants." And he said, "That's true. What's this business about, relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will?" And he said, "Your bondage is self. All you think about is you. You don't think about anybody else unless it has to do with you. So, you know, it's like you got a periscope that's wired to your body and it's aimed right at your forehead. And all you can see is you. And what we want to do is be relieved of that so we can be of service to other people. And then take away my difficulties." I like that part. "That victory over them may bear witness to those that would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always." And he said, "When you come back next week and we get on our knees and say this third step prayer, you better mean it, because God's going to be a whole lot more serious about this than you are." So I came back the next week and he looked at me and he said, "Do you want to do this?" And I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Then I can't help you." And I said, "You misunderstood me. You asked me if I wanted to do it. I don't want to do it, but I will do it." And so we all got on our knees and held hands and said the third step prayer, and then I got up afterwards, and he started laughing, which I thought was inappropriate also. And I said, "What's so damn funny?" And he said, "You don't want to give God that kind of power in your life, right?" And I said, "Right." And he said, "God's got all the power anyway, Bob. This is just an exercise in who's God and who's the drunk." And then he said, "Did you bring your legal pad with you?" And he explained to me that you could take a third step as often as you want to, but unless it's followed by a rigorous attempt to clean the house, it'll have little permanent effect. So I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "Yeah, I need you to write a grudge list of all the people you don't like." And I said, "Well, that's about everybody I ever met." And he said, "I don't care. I want you to write a grudge list." And I said, "All right." And he said, "What I want you to do is I want you to put this name in the first column, and I want you to write all the names, and then you can come back. And in the second column, I want you to write down what they did to you that made you angry. But don't spend a lot of time there, or not more than 5 or 6 words, because you don't learn anything in the second column." And he said, "In the third column, what I want you to do is I want you to write down what was affected, your self-esteem, your security, your ambitions, your personal relations, your sex relations." And I said, "Okay." And at that point, I was traveling as a salesperson, and I'd get in motels at night, and I'd sit down and write inventory. And so I wrote all these columns out, and I came back, and I said, "Okay, I'm done." And he said, "No, you're not. Now I want you to write another column," and that was where you were selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened. So off I went again and wrote all this stuff down, and I came back and said, "All right, there it is." And he said, and I said, "Now I'm done." And he said, "No. Now you need to write a fear inventory." And I said, "Don, you don't remember, but I spent years as a bill collector in Chicago. And I was this 240-pound psychopath that used to kick in people's doors and bang them up against the wall until they fainted or did whatever the hell they were going to do. And I'm not afraid of anything." "You too." So he said, "Well, the big book says that fear is an evil and corroding thread and that the fabric of our existence is shot through with it." And he said, "But apparently yours isn't." And I said, "Apparently not." So he said, "Well, just humor me, will you?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "How about snakes?" And I said, "What kind of snakes?" And he said, "How about rattlesnakes?" And I said, "Well, I wouldn't want to be in a closet with one." And he said, "Good thinking. Write down rattlesnakes. How about spiders?" And I said, "Like black widows?" "Oh, you're way the hell ahead of me here." And he said, "Yeah, black widows are good." And I said, "Well, you wouldn't want to pick one up." And he said, "No, you wouldn't. So write down black widows." "How about failure?" "Oh, cheap shot." Well, I was told from the time I was about 10 years old, "Your dad's a drunk, your mother's a Looney Tune, and you got no no chance at all. And he said, how about inadequacy? And I said, well, I never thought I was as good as other people. And he said, that's a good reason. Write down inadequacy. How about women? Well, he said, just write down women. How about the police? Well, you know, like when squad cars come up behind you? And he said, yeah, that's good. And I said, yeah, I don't like that. And he said, write down the police. How about the courts? And I said, Don, you know, I was sentenced to prison when I was 17 for assault with a deadly weapon. And the only reason why I got off was because back then they would say, would you rather spend your time in prison or in the military? And I said, well, I think the military is a good option. And but I didn't trust the court. He said, how about kids? And I said, just the really little ones when they got them all wrapped up. I'm always afraid I'm going to drop them. And then he just sat there and stared at me. And after a few minutes, he said, is there anything you're not afraid of? And I said, I guess not. You know, it's curious. The book says that once we begin to outgrow fear, but it doesn't say we outgrow fear. So fear is going to be a companion of some variety, probably for the rest of our lives. But not like it was. Not that sort of bone-chilling thing that would stop you absolutely in your tracks. We don't have to live a life that is full of fear. We just don't. And part of the recovery in this program has to do with getting past all that by taking a look. I think that there are so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous who don't take advantage of this sort of introspection that we do in the steps to find out what the problems, what the impediments are to recovery for us. And see, the group that I belong to goes through the steps once a year. We all do, not at the same time, but we average about once a year. So we start at one, take a look again at whether we're really alcoholics, and then go all the way through to 12. Now, you might think that there is a law of diminishing return there. There's not. And until you tried that, you probably wouldn't, I don't know whether you believe it or not, but I can tell you after having done that for almost as many years as I've been sober, that it's become apparent to me that if you continue to seek a spiritual experience through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you will continue to have spiritual experiences. Let me give you an example. When I was 28 years sober, I'm doing my 11th step and I'm talking to God, and you know, I don't ever expect an answer, I just talk. And so I'm saying to God, well, I'm 28 years sober, and I don't know why I understand, why I still believe all of this crazy stuff about who and what I am. And I was saying to God, I still believe that if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. I still believe that I'm not good enough. I still believe that I'll never be a success. I still believe that I am a fraud. I still believe, da-da-da-da. What's the problem? I mean, Jesus, haven't I written enough inventory? And see, there's twice in my life that I've heard voices. Now, and I'm reluctant to say this to you because it denotes a certain irrational thought pattern. And I am five steps to the right of conservative. I don't believe in voices. I believe if you can see it, it's good. And I'm starting to hear a voice. And the voice, I said, what's going on here? What do I have to do to get rid of this? And what I heard was principles. Well, the book talks about principles in a whole bunch of places, and sometimes it describes it differently. So I said, no. This is spiritual make-believe, and I'm hearing voices, and I probably should take a nap. And I said, principles are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And the voice that I heard said, no, principles are those self-defeating beliefs that are so buried in your personality that you stop challenging them. And they influence every decision that you make negatively. And they will prevent you from ever becoming the person that God intended you to be. And I said, well, so what do you do? And the voice I heard said, put the belief in the first column. And I said, this doesn't sound like AA. And he said, and I'm hearing, no. When it describes the inventory, it says people, institutions, and principles. And these beliefs have become the principles which guide your life. And it's about damn time you got rid of them. So I said, what do I do? And he said, put the belief in the first column. So I got out my legal pad and I wrote down in the first column, if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. And then in the second column, I looked in my book and it says the cause. And so I wrote down, I believe this. I was told when I was 10 years old that I had no chance to succeed in life. And then I went over in the third column thinking, this is just stupid. And it said, does this affect your self-esteem? Oh my God. It destroys your self-esteem. Does it affect your security? Yeah, you know, if somebody's going to catch up to me at some point and say, hey, you're not the guy we thought you were, so let's cut the cord right here. I can't ever get secure in a job. I can't ever get secure in a relationship. Can't ever get secure in anything. Does it affect my ambitions? Yeah, because nothing's going to work. So why would I try something if I'm going to fail at it? Does it affect my personal relations? Yeah, why would I have any? Does it affect my sex relations? Yeah. Those are just personal relations on steroids. And then I had to go in the fourth column where it says, where were we selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened? It's selfish for me to believe something that I know at some level that those things are lies. I know they're really nasty lies, and I know they prevent me from becoming the person I could be, but I'm tired of challenging all this stuff. You know, that stuff's buried so deep that I don't even want to go looking for it. I'm afraid what I'm going to find. And it's selfish to do that, to not challenge something that's wrecking your life just because you don't want to look at it. And it's dishonest to believe a lie. And it's self-seeking because it allows me to be a victim. So I can explain away every failure I've had in my life by saying the two greatest lies in the world. One of them is, well, that's the way it is. And the other one is, well, that's the way I am. And I found out that even with 28 years of sobriety, I had a head full of nonsense about who and what I was. I used to really piss off my customers. I would go to them and say, well, I'm just this farm kid from Wisconsin. Oh, my God. They said, you're one of the most astute business people we know, and you're coming up with that bullshit? You knock that off right now. I can't hide behind all of those things I protected myself with. See, and if I have never, ever met anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous who hasn't come in here with a head full of nonsense. And the greatest tragedy in Alcoholics Anonymous is for us not to look. It's for us to say, okay, well, that's the way it is. And then never become the person we could be. You know the only reason why I'd fly out here on a weekend? Is because I don't want you to spend the rest of your life believing a bunch of bullshit about who you are. Otherwise, I could have played golf with my kids this weekend. I had a head full of lies about who I was, and I am not any of those. Now I can tell you what the bottom line to that inventory is. The bottom line to that inventory is I am a child of God and an equal to anyone on the face of this planet. No better or no worse, but an equal to anyone on the face of this planet. And for me to spend my life walking around claiming to be damaged goods or second-class merchandise is pure, unadulterated bullshit. We are all children of God with special abilities, special skills, and if we deny them, we prevent ourselves from enjoying a happy and productive life. But, you know, that's everybody's choice. I wrote a sex inventory. I went into it thinking I was Don Juan. Came out of it thinking I was Elmer Fudd. Questions are, was it selfish or not? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? I found out those were tools that I used. I used jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness as tools in a relationship so that whoever I was in a relationship with would never get both feet on the ground. That is an ugly, mean thing to do. But I was afraid that if they ever got both feet on the ground and got a good look at me, they'd be out of there faster than I could spit. So I kept them off balance. I never let them get a good look. And I can tell you that relationships don't work very well that way. So when I went through the sex inventory, I found out that I was selfish in every relationship I'd ever been in. And I'm not proud of that. Is there a band back there? When I... She'd tell the cymbal section to quiet down. I made a list of all persons I'd harmed. I did it when I took inventory. The one that I didn't want to make amends to was, well, a lot of people. I mean, I was a bill collector. And I used to kick these doors in and stuff, and then I had to go back to Chicago and find as many of those people as I could. And I told my sponsor I was probably going to get shot if I did that. And he said, well, God either is or he isn't. So I did. I owed a great deal of money. And I started paying 30% of my net income. And it took the better part of 3 years. And then one day I was very close to being paid off. Actually, it was $2,500 away. And I took my kids to a boat show. And they had Bassmasters had a raffle on a bass boat, and it was three chances for $10, and they had $10 of my money before I knew I had it out of my pocket. And I felt like Jack and the Beanstalk just sold the cow for beans. And then they called me up the next day and told me I won it. This is a long time ago. And so I went down there with my two sons. And they're climbing around in the boat going, oh boy, Dad, we're going to be able to go fishing, and we're going to go water skiing, and we're going to do all the rest of this stuff. And I asked the Rebel bass boat dealer how much the boat was worth, and he said, wholesale is $2,500. Oh. And then this Texan came up to me, and he said, you want to sell the boat? And I said, for how much? And he said, I'll give you $2,500 cash. So, what do you do? Do you sell the boat and pay off the rest of your men's? Or do you keep paying off your men's, keep the boat, take the kids fishing, and do all that stuff? What do you do? The book says that the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. So I told my kids I couldn't do it. And I went over the next day and met this Texan at the bank, and he gave me $2,500, and I paid out the rest of my amends and promised my kids that at some point, as soon as I could, we'd have a boat. And 2 years later, I bought a 17.5-foot Cobalt with a Boss 302 Ford V8 engine in it. That you could troll at 60 miles an hour. I went to see my dad. When did this start? I don't want to keep you glued to your seats. I went to my dad, who was the mend I didn't want to make. He had had a stroke. And they told me he was incapable of any kind of continuous thought. And I went to the Grand Army home in King, Wisconsin, and saw him. And I told my sponsor, I don't want to do that. He was the one that caused all the problems. You know, I don't see the harm. And he said, didn't he try to call you every year on your birthday? And I said, yeah. And he said, what'd you do? And I said, hung up on him. And he said, why'd you do that? And I said, because he was so drunk, I couldn't understand him. And he said, yeah, but don't you think you should have at least tried to talk to him? And I said, he was drunk. And my sponsor said, you're a drunk. It's good logic to me. He said, get in your car and go to amends, and go make your amends in Wisconsin to him, and I don't care whether he understands or not. And that's the kind of sponsorship I had. So I drove to Wisconsin, and I walked in the Grand Army home, and here's this little old man sitting in a wheelchair. And I said, I'm looking for Bob Olson. And they said, that's him right over there. And I walked over to him, and I said, I'm your son, Bob. And he looked up, and at some level he understood who I was. And I wheeled him back. into this little room and I said, I'm an alcoholic. And he got very sad, visibly. And I said, but I'm part of a fellowship named Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've harmed you, and part of our program of recovery is to make amends for those things that we've done to harm others. And I've held you at arm's length my whole life because I didn't understand your alcoholism until I was an alcoholic. But I don't have to drink anymore. And then he became visibly elated. And I told him that I would do whatever I could to balance the books. And then I drove home, and shortly after that he died. He died of gangrene. He had adult onset diabetes, and same thing I have. And they called my uncle Leif, and they said, we're going to have to amputate his feet because they're turning black and it'll kill him eventually. So they amputated his feet, and then they had to amputate his arm, or part of his arm. And then one day they called him up and they said, we're running out of pieces here. So you want to have some more amputations, or do you just want to let him die? And it was my uncle's considered opinion that letting him die was the kindest thing, and I've never questioned that. So my dad would sit in the lobby of this hospital, and every time anyone came close to him, he would scream. Couldn't talk. So he would scream. And what happened to him was about the four horses of alcoholism: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And despair is the worst, because there is no hope. My dad knew at some level that they were going to let him die, and he couldn't do a damn thing about it, and wasn't part of the decision. So he died. And that's the way alcoholics die. My dad was married 9 times. The only person that was at his funeral was his brother. Now, I'll tell you a little something that really threw me in sobriety. When my dad died, my uncle called me up and said, your dad just died. And I said, okay, thanks. And he said, don't come to the funeral. We're just going to have this little service up behind the hospital. You don't need to send any flowers. You don't need to do anything. And anyway, I know how you feel about your dad. And I said, well, okay. And so I hung up, and my wife at the time said, who was that? And I said, Uncle Leif. And she said, what do you have to say? And I said, he said, my dad died. And she went, oh my God, I'm so sorry. And I said, don't be. Now, when my father died, I never shed a tear. And I thought, whoa, I must be wired wrong. Something's wrong here. I mean, aren't you supposed to at least shed a tear when your parent dies? And I thought, well, maybe it's because I got beat up a lot by my dad. But when my mother dies, that's going to be an entirely different deal. And then my mother died. And I could not shed a tear. And I went to my sponsor and I said, I must be crazy. I can't dredge up a tear for either one of my parents. And he said, Bob, what you grew up in didn't look like a normal family. It looked like World War III. And you lived in all these foster homes, and you never had a parent relationship, and you never had any of this stuff, so I am not surprised at all that you're taking this traditional view about wanting to cry about your parents, and you can't bring yourself to do it. Now, why did I mention that? Because if you grew up like I did, and you can't do that, that's pretty normal. So I hope if any of you have had that experience, that just understand that that wasn't part of what we were brought up with. And so anyway, I do a lot of 10 steps. 10 step says continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When you see it, ask God who wants to remove it. Make amends if you've harmed anyone, and then resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. We have 10-step buddies. Now, if you're in selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, and you don't want to carry it around for the next 5 days, call somebody and tell them what you're in. And then those people that we call say, did you ask God to remove it? Did you harm someone? Did you make amends? And have you resolutely turned your thoughts to someone you can help? You know, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear about turning inward. And the way I get to turn out again is by turning my thoughts to someone I can help. That's the trick in the 10th step. 11th's about discipline. I mean, my sponsor, I'm sponsoring two guys right now that I am all over about the 11th step. And it's all about discipline. It's what you do when you wake up in the morning. It's what you do when you go to bed at night. Pause when agitated or doubtful. Ask for the right thought or action. If you don't do that, you're settling for half a loaf. And then there's the 12th step. You know, the tough part isn't working with others. If you understand how you got sober, if you've been through the program of recovery, 12th step isn't difficult. You just start laying it out in front of people and see if they want it. Practicing these principles in all our affairs is the difficult part. It is. There was this guy in Denver called Big Frank. And he was an attorney. He had been drafted by the New York Giants, which are the football Giants. Show you how big a guy this was. This is a guy that was about 6'7" and about 300 pounds. And he was this attorney, and he just loved to argue about everything. And he would come up to me and say, "What are your principles?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure." And he said, "Then you don't have any." He would say things like, "Do you have the courage of your convictions?" And I'd go, "Yeah." And he'd go, "Can you prove it?" "Go away." "What do you stand for?" "Mom, apple pie." I don't know what the hell. I was talking to Clancy before the thing at this meeting, and was talking and told him how important I thought what he was saying about singleness of purpose was. We don't want to lose this. This is way too important. Just because somebody wants us to be a catch-all for everything does not ensure the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And see, my people have been dying from alcoholism ever since I got here from Norway. And what if my kids turn out to be drunks? I've got 5 sons and 2 grandsons, and they all love me. I have 2 ex-wives who don't. It's the price you pay. I went from being what people thought to be dangerously antisocial, to be a criminal, to be an antisocial, dangerously antisocial person. Today, I am one of the largest providers of psychiatric care and therapy to the Colorado Department of Corrections. How do you get from there to here? How do you find the kind of wellness in Alcoholics Anonymous where the whole State Department of Corrections wants to use you to develop all their programs? That's not supposed to work like that. How do you get the love of everyone? How do you get the respect of your friends and your peers? How do you get your life to change? You got to change your mind. And the only way I know how to change my mind is through this introspection. So the question that I have for you is, aren't you curious? Don't you want to know what you really could be? Don't you want to know what's preventing you from doing that? Don't you want to see what the vision of God's will for you is? I hope you have the courage to take a look. Thanks.